This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps, and each week with an inspiring guest, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. So, here we go. Hey, we're back, and this week we're talking all about menstruation as a factor in mental health and getting into a lot of the parallel stigmas when it comes to things we're not meant to talk about. And meant in very heavy quotation marks, of course. And my guest this week is Kate Weston, who's a writer, a former comedian, an all-round brilliant human, who I've actually wanted to interview for a little while, which I didn't say to her face, but it was a lovely surprise when I had this pitch through to my emails that she'd written a new book, which is a murder mystery, which is both very entertaining in its writing, but also looks to normalize menstruation and the products that relate to it in a way that is just kind of high art camp to me. It's just out there. And I'm not even going to say what I mean by that. You can wait till she talks about the book because it's a fun one. As was this interview, we got on really well, had great chats, covered a lot, including her experiences of OCD, borderline personality disorder, and an eating disorder as she went through the years figuring out her mental health without, like many of us, the information that it would have been nice to have, but also finding out all the ways in which your cycle can influence your mental health and vice versa in a way that is not nearly talked about enough. So today we are talking about it, but first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows how to help you save. This July 4th, get up to 40% off select Maytag laundry appliances. Plus, get an additional 10% off when you buy two or three select major appliances. And when you buy four or more, you'll save an additional 20%. Find the right appliances and features that fit your home's unique needs and style. Shop Maytag 4th of July deals at Lowe's. Valid through 7/9. See Lowe's.com for details. Savings vary based on purchase amount. Selection varies by location.
Hi, I'm Kate Weston. I think maybe the first experience I had of any kind of mental illness was when I was really young, actually. But I don't think I knew at the time that it was mental illness or what it was. So when I was around about age 10, 11, I started having to do things like if I scratched my left arm, I had to scratch my right arm. Because otherwise I would worry that my family, like someone in my family would die or something really awful would happen. And that sort of really progressed to having to do things in even numbers. So if I touched, like say my leg on my left hand side of my body, I'd have to touch my right leg, keep everything balanced. And when that was going on, I also had to wash my hands like frequently and touching light switches and things. If I turned a light switch on and off, I'd have to touch it four times. Because I was quite young, I think 10 and 11, quite young to have those kind of thoughts and experiences. I didn't know what was going on, so I didn't tell anyone. And I didn't, in fact, tell anyone until in my 30s, I think. And that was something that I really, I hid it quite well as a kid. Not that makes it sound like it was a good thing to do to hide it, but obviously it was not a good thing to do to hide it. But I obviously must have hid it quite well when I was a kid because no one really picked up on it.
Yeah. And then, I just want to pause on that actually, because I think there's something there around how easily we can soak up the stigma, even if we have no idea what it is we're doing with these behaviors, what might be causing it, and that it could be within the realm of mental illness. There can still be that innate thing that we've soaked up of, this is something to hide.
Yeah. I just thought like, oh, if I tell anyone, They'll think I'm weird. They'll think there's something wrong with me. I'll never have friends because I didn't have a lot of friends when I was growing up. So it's like, I'll never have friends. I will never be like normal, like my brothers and sisters. I'll be like a letdown to everyone, basically. And I think that's something that people really feel with mental illness, isn't it? But when you're a kid, you don't even realize that you're doing those things. It's just something that naturally happens. And I think it was quite interesting that when I wrote my first book and it has the main character in it suffers from depression and anxiety, and she has kind of like symptoms of OCD, but you never actually get to a diagnosis for her. And when I wrote that book, people I went to school with actually got in touch with me and said, did you used to do this when you were a kid, touching the light switch and things like that? And I said, yeah. And they were like, yeah, me too. And there was like, obviously other kids around me growing up at the same time as me experiencing the same thing, but none of us told each other about it. And I got quite sad because I was like, that's actually really like, imagine if we'd known that we could talk about it, how much like time it would have saved us. And yeah.
Agreed. One of my closest friends was going to therapy whilst we were at school together, and I never knew. And I think about it all the time because I don't think I was somebody that he wouldn't have been able to talk to. But equally, I wasn't starting those conversations either. You know, I was hiding my own stuff. So, you know, we were both actually exhibiting not just some of the same kind of struggles, but also the same hiding, masking behaviours. And it is so common.
Yeah, it's so common. And it just makes you go like, okay, so this is why we have the conversations now, but also like makes you realize how young you have to start those conversations as well. So yeah, that was kind of the beginning of things. And that kind of also developed into an eating disorder and depression and anxiety. And then I wasn't actually diagnosed with borderline personality disorder until I was 30. Which is quite late, actually. And I had to really push for a diagnosis because I was like, you know, I kept getting like shipped around with therapists and told like, oh no, you need like a different kind of therapy. Like I'd start a course of CBT and they'd say, actually, I don't think this is for you and we need you to do something else. But no one would ever like tell me what was going on. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I kind of feel like if, you know, like it was making me feel worse. It was making me feel like there was something so wrong with me that I couldn't even have therapy.
Yeah.
Like I've even been like, you know, kicked out of therapy. What's going on? So I kind of really pushed for the borderline personality disorder diagnosis. Well, I didn't know what I was pushing for a diagnosis of. I was just sort of pushing for any kind of diagnosis to help. So when I was diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, I was very much like quite shocked and I didn't really know what it was. And a lot of the stuff when you Google borderline personality disorder, a lot of the stuff that comes up is just ill-informed and it's not quite right, and it's much better now, but at the time all this stuff came up that was like people who are really manipulative and things like that. So it was describing it as like a sort of like you are a bad person, basically.
Yeah, it can be really damning, and that is, you know, part of the specific stigma around borderline personality disorder that contributes to that sort of hot potato situation of you being passed around to different services. And yes, often the diagnosis sort of floating there and not being confirmed or not being told to you. I've spoken to a previous guest where it was very explicitly said to her by a doctor, this is what you have, but are you really sure you want it on your records? Are you really sure you want this diagnosis? And I don't just blame that professional in that situation because the stigma is so rampant, but that shows you when it's getting to the people that most academically should know better. And I want to talk about that more with you, but first, can we go back a little bit to when the eating disorder symptoms started and what was that escalation like to live through at a young age?
Looking back now, I know that it was a way of, because I obviously had all this stuff going on in my head and all these kind of like OCD symptoms, basically. And all this stuff going on and I didn't know what was going on and I couldn't control it. And I know now from therapy, obviously, that the eating disorder was a way of like getting control of something because I felt like everything was so outside of my control. So really all I remember was just going, I'm going to do like, I like nothing is going well for me. Like everything is bad. And I'm going to like restrict what I eat and make sure that I'm like as thin as I can possibly be. I'm going to make sure that there's no way that anyone can criticize my appearance. Because also when I was a kid, a lot of, and I think kids at school say this a lot, but like the first boy I ever told I fancied, he was like laughed at me and told me I was ugly. And I think that happens a lot. Like I think that, and he wasn't the only one to do it. It was kind of like a bit of a playground joke about how ugly I was as a kid. I mean, looking back now, I'm like, I was quite fragile, like, because I had all this other stuff going on and I was already worried I was like super weird. So then you're like, add like boys calling me ugly to that. And I was literally just at the end of my kind of tether. And I think restricting my eating was just a way of trying to control like one of these things. But obviously that's not the way to go. It's not helpful. And now, like, as a grown up, I know all that stuff. And that's like great to know that now. But when you're a kid, you don't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
I think when I was young, all the talk was like, if you have an eating disorder, it's because of the media and pictures of Kate Moss that have done it. And you were like, wow, like that's a lot of blame on one woman. And actually, I think we understand eating disorders a bit better now to understand what the crux of them is. And that it's not just one picture of one skinny person or one model that's going to do it for you. There's a whole load of, I mean, obviously that's a part of it, but there's a whole load of stuff that goes on.
No, I agree. It's something we have to be very careful of, addressing these media factors, but also not doing so in a way that belittles the experience of, oh, you saw too many pictures of Photoshop celebrities and that's why you've got this medical disorder. That's not the whole story. As much as it can be a factor, you know, I sort of think the more that you look into this, the more it maybe goes the other way. That if for a million different reasons we can find ourselves with an eating disorder, I have experience of anorexia myself. I see it now more the other way, where all of that media portrayal stuff can be such a factor in how hard it is to move on from, how hard it is to recover, because every way you turn, it's so, so easy to find images and rhetoric and narratives that back up the eating disorder voice, that confirm it. And so I actually have come to see the cause and effect a lot more that way, that if we do go down that road, it's that stuff that can embolden it as opposed to it ever being a simple cause and effect.
Yeah, definitely. You put that so much better than I ever felt.
I've had a lot of practice. But yeah, I relate to this stuff a lot. And I do find particular fascination in, like you, what happens when we don't have the education? It's so vital, because as you described there, not knowing better, how could you? What choice did you have?
Yeah. And also, like, how do you even know at that age? Like, obviously now we have like the internet and stuff, but at that age, like, I didn't even have like Google or anything, you know, not that that necessarily always helps. How do you even know what questions to ask or, you know, where to begin? And that sort of leads into why I wanted to write about periods so much and why I focus on menstruation so much, because it's all sort of around the same age, where around the age I started menstruating was around the age that my mental health started really taking like its biggest nosedive. And I think that's why it's so important to talk about mental health and menstruation together, because I think when you're taught at school, certainly when I was taught at school, it was very much like, you're going to bleed once a month for a few days. Like, it's fine. Don't make a big deal out of it, sort of thing. Oh, and don't talk to the boys about it because they'll find it really awkward. And you just kind of like look at that now and you go, that was a like really unhelpful. Because we should be talking to everyone about it. We shouldn't be like splitting the class by gender. We shouldn't be gendering it in the first place. Like, we should all be talking about this together, because it's something that affects such a huge proportion of people. But also, like, menstruation is so much more than just bleeding for a few days. There's a whole load of stuff that goes on with your hormones that can just have such a profound impact on you as a person. And it can make you feel like at that age, like you're completely changing as a person. You're like, why aren't I how I used to be? Like, why am I suddenly crying at like the drop of a hat? Like, why am I like raging about something that I wouldn't have cared about a week ago? Like, why am I suddenly this kind of person that I don't even recognize anymore? And a lot of it's down to all the hormones that are going on. But no one ever says to you, like, take care of your mental health, because some really serious stuff can go on when this is happening, and talk to people about how you're feeling. You know, you're not weird. It's happening for everyone. They just say, well, here's some tampons. Have a nice time.
Good like, luck. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's true. And I think there's kind of a parallel here with what we were talking about earlier, that there is that innate self-consciousness we feel when our bodies are changing that much. And we do have, still today, not nearly enough access to the information we need at that age. Then people come along with this stuff of, oh, you shouldn't talk about this, particularly not to the boys. And, you know, you should keep these products, you know, they're going to help you, but you need to keep them hidden. Young people are very vulnerable to that, because, again, it confirms what you're feeling. I'm embarrassed about this, and I should be, because we don't talk about it.
Yeah, when actually, like, why should you be embarrassed about it when it's like a natural bodily function? It's something that happens that you have no control over. And I wrote a piece for the bookseller recently about the proportion of books that were for kids with like funny titles around like poos and farts and stuff, and how much they sell. But there's just not the same like jokes around periods. Like, you just don't have funny books about periods. And like, whereas I found a picture book called Baby Shark, which really like fed me, made me laugh like a little. And I was like, this is incredible, and I'm going to buy it for everyone I know. But like, at the same time, I was like, why can't we have like, you know, where the wild tampons are? Like, why is this so like taboo?
Yeah, because as silly as that example is, there is actually something kind of nice and funny and normalizing about the fact that we can make poo jokes. And that isn't a political stance. It's a neutral thing. It isn't, you know, talked about as something like, you know, a lot of women in comedy have weaponized against them. Or you're always talking about periods. I just can't see that with something that equally affects men.
Yeah. They wouldn't be like, God, you're always talking about your shit. Like, you just go, no. I used to get all the time. I'd get one of two things depending on what material I'd done that night when I was doing stand-up. So I would either get, you're funny because you don't focus on like your period and your vagina and stuff. Or I'd get, you are not funny because you talk about your period and your vagina too much. And there was kind of like no way of winning, because one way you're just not funny, and the other way you're funny, but only because you're not talking about it.
Yeah, well, essentially that sounds a lot like you're funny despite being a woman, or you would be funny if you stopped talking about being a woman. And, you know, it's similar to the ridiculousness of how menstruation isn't talked about. You know, is looking up the stats, and one of them is that 300 million people around the world right now are on their period. And I can't think of anything else where 300 million people would be experiencing it in this second, and we'd be acting like it doesn't happen every single month.
Yeah, and of that 300 million people, like, how many of them have to shove a tampon up their sleeve before they go to the bathroom, or like feel like they can't tell anyone, or have someone saying something like, oh, but you deal so well with your periods, it's like they don't even happen. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, why should anyone behave as if their period isn't happening? Mm-hmm. Like, usually the people that don't menstruate that say these things, and you go, look, if you were bleeding profusely from a body part, what would you do? Would you talk about it, or would you just pretend it's not happening? Like, it's strange to me. But yeah, the other thing that I sort of find really kind of like fascinating is, so people that say to me, that are grown adults, that say, well, it's embarrassing. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, so most of these people are grown adults, and some of them have had children, and yet they think that periods are embarrassing. You're like, you have like procreated and stuff, you are like a complete grown-up. What are you going to say to your children when they start menstruating? Like, how's that going to go down? And I did say to one once, this teacher had said to me, you know, don't expect too much from the class, because what you're talking about is quite embarrassing. And I just said, like, what's embarrassing about it? I'm doing it right now. And his face was just like pure horror. I can't believe you're telling me that. And I was like, well, loads of people in this room are like, it's just happening all around you. So
yeah. And I really strongly believe that, you know, this is so negative for all of us. Whenever I'm in a relationship with a woman, if I'm living with a woman, I would rather know. I would rather be there to support you. I'd rather know to like give an extra bit of grace. If your moods are less predictable, please include me. You know, it benefits all of us to have these conversations. And yeah, I think we're just so on the same page of it being so ridiculous and yet it's so normalized. Yeah. And what you shared there about the school, I've heard you talk about similar examples where it often is the kids that had the least education or were seen as the most embarrassed around certain topics. Not only was that often a reflection of the teachers far more than the students, but also you were finding that that shame actually correlated very strongly with interest. They were the kids that needed this conversation the most.
Yeah, like they really were, because kids are still going to menstruate whether or not you want to talk to them about it or not. They're still going to have questions. And, you know, and I do think it's particularly important from a mental health point of view that we do make sure all kids know about it, whether or not they're going to menstruate, because there's so much that can go wrong and it might take someone else to notice it for you to kind of be able to get help. So there's things like, obviously there's PMS, which is actually, I know it's like a joke and people are like, oh, she's PMSing, but it's actually quite serious and quite, you know, can be quite debilitating.
Just as a general rule, anything that's diagnosable, it's not a joke. Yeah. Like I'm not going to stand for that in mental health. I'm not going to stand for it in physical.
Exactly. And then sort of like a more severe version of PMS is PMDD, which actually like 5 to 8% suffer from. Premenstrual dysphoric disorder. And it's kind of like PMS, but on a much more severe level. So it can lead to sort of like really severe depression, suicidal thoughts, like really, it's a really serious thing. And it can happen like 1 to 2 weeks before your period. And when you're in that bad of a way, like you probably know from experience as I do, sometimes it takes for someone else to notice that you're in such a bad place before you can even get help or before you can, you know, sort of realize yourself that things have got that bad. So I think
part of that is very clear in a situational way, that when something is having such an effect on your emotions, that is also going to affect your ability to figure a way out of it, you know, to find the logic, to find the answers when you're firefighting, to feel okay. And, you know, I'm glad that you've brought it up, because that is a condition where the mental health impact could hardly be more obvious. Most of the symptoms are things like sleep problems, are mood swings, are feeling upset or tearful and not knowing why. And that's scary across the board.
Yeah. And you just think with this whole attitude of like, oh, people should be quiet about their periods and it's no big deal and all of this stuff. When you suffer from something like that, that just, I mean, how hopeless would you feel to just be like, okay, but every time I have my period, it's so much worse than that. And you feel like you can't talk to other people about it then, because you sort of feel like you're not coping as well as others and you shouldn't be talking about it because it's shameful and all this stuff. And you just go, no, let's all just, A, talk about it from the start, educate people properly about periods, educate people properly about what it involves to be going through the menstrual cycle, and not just on a, like, textbook biological level, not just on a, like, have a free tampon level, but, like, on a level of, like, you know, emotionally, it's going to be really hard. And it's the same, I mean, it's the same with having babies. A lot of the emotional and mental stuff that happens when people have babies is sort of brushed under the carpet. And then it comes as a real shock to people when they have a baby. And there's like a thing that happens on, I haven't had babies, but my friends have. So I know from experience that there's a thing that happens on like day 3 after you've given birth, where your hormones are just wild and you have like this massive crash. And people always kind of go, why does no one talk about this? Why is it not talked about on a much larger scale? because it's so dangerous. Like, it's such a sort of dangerous time. But
and also a time when you're so vulnerable.
Yeah,
and you combine
exactly.
that vulnerability with the natural human inclination to be in that space and internalize it and think, am I a horrible mother because I'm not coping? I'm only 3 days in and I'm feeling this bad. I must be yeah. awful. I must be doomed. What have I got myself into? Much like how you described, you know, going through initially having your periods and yearning for a time when you might have felt more fun. Or you were like, yeah. I didn't cry as much. And so you're taking that as it's some kind of fault with me. What happened to my personality versus this is actually something that half the class is going through right now.
Yeah. And if we all knew that, you know, maybe we could talk about it, but instead we're told not to, or we're told to be quiet about it, or someone tells us it's embarrassing when we talk about it, or someone gets a little bit about
which
it.
My question would be, to whom? To them, probably.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's not, you know, it's not fair as well, because I think when I've been into schools and I'm period positive and I'm, you know, and I talk about it really openly and I'm happy to talk about it openly. And I'm quite kind of like staunch about it now. I will not have someone trying to belittle mm-hmm. it or shame me or anything like that. But I think at the start of that journey, I could have easily been shamed out of it. And I think that stops a lot of people. I think it was only because I had so many issues with my own periods that I kept having to go to doctors who were, I mean, you get kind of like a variety with doctors. You get the ones that kind of just don't want to talk about it and are just like, look, I'm going to give you a painkiller and if you could just take that once a month and be quiet sort of thing. And then you get ones that say, well, what do you want me to do about it? And I'm like, well, I don't know. You're a doctor. Like, why do I tell you? Like, I don't know. And you just get sort of this, you know, I don't think it's taken as seriously as it can be when you go with another sort of physical ailment. It just seems like it's not taken as seriously as that. And it's, you know, that's really frustrating. So, yeah, I've gone off on a tangent.
No, but it's difficult not to, right? Because so much of this is structural problems. In the same way, when we bring in the mental health diagnoses parallels, that is things that you can't see. Many of the symptoms are emotional things that can't be observed in an easy way. I would argue they can be observed by the right doctor that knows what to look out for, but they can equally be ignored easier than something very physical and obvious that is right there. That combined with the stigma, that combined with how certain things aren't taken seriously, it very much exists for menstruation as well. And so, you know, I think sometimes those doctors, much like we talked about with BPD, maybe partly succumbing to, well, they've never been given proper yeah. support, and maybe their own workplace, despite being exactly the kind of place that should know better, doesn't give them the time off when they need, if they're unable to work for how bad their pain is. And instead it's have this pill, grit your teeth, see your next patient.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that is the way that doctors have dealt with menstruation issues for a long time, is like a painkiller or a pill, like mask the issue and move on. But that doesn't actually help, because a lot of the time there can be more serious stuff going on, things like endometriosis and stuff like that. And, you know, just putting a plaster on things like that is also detrimental to your mental health, because you can feel like you are literally going crazy. Because you'll be like, well, something's going on with my body. Something really painful is going on with my body. No one's taking me seriously. I feel like I'm imagining it, or I'm exaggerating or something. And yet once a month, I am in this incredible, unbearable pain. And I think that has a massive impact on mental health as well. And that's, you know, even before the fact that periods affect your mental health in the first place.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah. I sometimes describe that kind of stuff as like societal gaslighting, that it's yeah. not one specific person and it's not necessarily people doing it on purpose, but we can find ourselves in that point that exacerbates it so much more, that we're already feeling awful and then we're at that weird crossroads of being told, oh, this happens to everyone, you know, you'll be okay, yeah. but also nobody is talking about it, so you still feel crazy.
Yeah, exactly.
And so Tell me for you then, you've experienced so much of this firsthand in terms of going through changes with your body, in terms of feeling shame around that, in terms of feeling loss over certain ways in which you may have felt more control of your emotions pre-menstruation and also pre-certain mental health symptoms. And was then fighting for and getting that diagnosis of BPD a turning point there?
Definitely, yeah. And I also did get a diagnosis of OCD quite recently, about a year ago as well, which a lot of people are surprised I didn't get sooner, but it took me longer than others to figure out what was going on. But yeah, definitely really helpful, and also made me realize just how much like the symptoms of BPD that I was dealing with and the symptoms of OCD that I was dealing with, they get so much worse in like the week before my period. And so now knowing that, I kind of know what's going on a little better. Mm-hmm. And it's not like I have like a schedule of like, this week's going to be a bad OCD week or anything. But when I start to feel that kind of shift, I know what it is, as opposed to being like, oh no, what's going on? Am I having a breakdown? What's happening? This is quite scary. Now it can be like, okay, this is just going to be this week. This works with this cycle. This is just going to be this week. I just have to get through this week. And, you know, obviously telling people around me, like, you know, if I feel I need to, just being like, yeah, this week's going to be hard. Sorry.
Yeah. And there definitely can be something I find so empowering about normalizing these experiences through actually having the context, through having the information to empower us to see that, okay, this is how I'm feeling today. And okay, I can see how that relates to my cycle. I can see how that relates to these diagnoses. And actually within that context, this can actually be very normal. You know, these same things that I felt abnormal and shame around actually follow a clear line of logic. And there are things that I can do. But a lot of that is because I know now what's going on and what I can do. And I've heard you talk about before, a big factor for you and something that's so often recommended for BPD is group therapy. Can mm-hmm. you tell me about that?
Yeah. Group therapy is really the only thing that they really like solidly recommend for BPD. I think they say like, that's kind of it. And it was the most terrifying thing I think I've ever done. Initially, I did two groups because I did like a first group that was more like a class where you did kind of like you do like scenarios and stuff, and you learn sort of like the theory and they break down things for you. And then the second lot was more of a kind of like talking in a big group. And that was quite scary because initially I didn't want to tell everyone in this big group all of the stuff that was going on in my head. And two, I think there were points in the group where I felt like I didn't deserve to be there because I didn't have it as hard as other people or whatever. And it's all, you don't realize it at the time, but it's all part of the kind of process of it. And so at the time, I remember thinking, I don't think I'm getting any better. I think I'm doing this hellish thing once a week. And all that's happening is that I'm just dreading this one event every week. And it wasn't until a little while after the therapy finished that I realized that actually things were feeling a lot better. And I did carry on seeing a different therapist after that therapy ended. And I think that also helped. So I know the group therapy helped, but I do also think seeing a therapist after the group therapy to kind of, it sounds like a bit weird, but to kind of like go through the therapy that I'd just been through.
No, I get that. And often that is recommended when people go to group therapy, that they go for individual therapy. And indeed, a lot of group specializing therapists do both. And so you can be kind of a double client of theirs for that reason of having the additional time to kind of decompress and reflect on an experience that both of you were in the room for and maybe unpick, okay, these are the ways in which I felt self-conscious or I thought that this person said that to upset me, and someone else that's a more neutral party in the room can be like, the usual therapist stuff. What makes you think that they said that to upset you? Let's find the logic then, you know? No, because you're right. It can be incredibly helpful. And a lot of that, you know, is why it's recommended for BPD, right? That is borderline personality disorder is a condition that so influences your self-esteem, your ability to regulate your emotions, and your ability to regulate your emotions within relationships to others. And so a lot of that can be worked through when you're in a room with other people in a way that when it's just you and the therapist, it's harder because they're purposely a neutral party. They are not reflective of the rest of the people you'll meet out in the world. And yet, whilst this stuff all makes sense within context, those specific stigmas that we talked about earlier are there in a way that actually often feels parallel to talking about periods, in that this stuff can be so often blamed on you of this being something that is affecting your ability to regulate your emotions is framed as you're overly emotional. It causing difficulties in relationships can be you're a horrible person, you're difficult to get on with.
And I think when you have BPD, you do think you are the worst person in every situation. You do think everything's your fault. You do think everyone hates you. So sitting in a room full of people who you don't know, who you have no kind of idea what their judgment of you might be, is really quite terrifying. So yeah, it's kind of, I guess it's kind of like a baptism of fire, isn't it? It's like just putting you in this situation, which is going to be your worst nightmare.
And yeah, it feels a bit like exposure therapy of we're going to drop you in it and let's see how long it takes you to realize they don't all hate you, that the sky isn't going to fall.
Yeah, or like even if they do hate you, what does it matter? What are they basing it on? What does it matter? Why, you know, you can't, I think one of the most important things that I learned was that you can't control how other people feel about you, like, and nor should you.
Oh, yes.
And it's really, like, none of your business whether they like you or not.
No, it's so important, and it's such a hard one realization, because I think even if we can understand that intellectually, that we're not in control of other people's feelings and other people's emotions can be just as unpredictable as ours, you know, we can give somebody something we think is bad news and they might be delighted, you know?
Yeah.
Some people love being fired from a job because they didn't know how to quit. There's a million ways in which we can be unpredictable as people. And so we can't control that. And yet it's really difficult. My therapist used to tell me that all the time, because I was so invested in everyone around me being happy that I'd taken it on as my personal crusade to control other people's feelings, which not only is impossible, but what I wasn't doing was trying to look after my own, which is the only ones we have somewhat control over.
Exactly. It's one of those things where it takes up such a lot of your time that you kind of realize afterwards, you're like, what have I spent the last 30 years of my life doing? And you're like literally sitting in a room worrying about every single conversation I've had with someone, every single interaction, picking it apart, trying to work out whether or not someone likes me, trying to work out why someone doesn't like me. And none of those things have been things I've wanted to do or wanted to spend my life doing. Yeah. And
making up worries for other people that they don't even have.
Inventing scenarios in my head of reasons why people don't like me, when actually either they've maybe not even noticed me, or they do like me, they've just not thought about it that deeply. Like, you know, it's a big time suck.
Yes, and not to be reductive about it, but perhaps when the alternative, more productive things we can do with that imagination is put it into writing. If we're going to imagine whole worlds, let's put it in a book. Let's get paid
for
it.
Why not?
Right? Is that my clunky transition we're going with?
Why not use it instead to write a little murder mystery?
Exactly. You're picking it up. So tell us about the book, which is, I think, a really clever combination of both a gripping plot that will, you know, keep people engaged, stop them, you know, wanting to put down the book for a second, but also has these elements of just normalizing, even just the tools that you use to deal with menstruation through them just being there, being not just neutral objects, actually quite ridiculous objects.
Yeah, so Murder on a School Night is a young adult comedy murder mystery where all the murders are either committed with or involving in some way menstrual products. And yes, so it focuses around Annie and Kerry, and it's narrated by Kerry. And they're two sixth formers, they're two best friends. They're very kind of like unpopular and nerdy, but are like very cool. I mean, I would 100% want to be friends with them. They are the coolest two characters I think I've ever written in my life. And they are total, like, they love crime fiction. They are like total Agatha Christie, like, nuts. They love it. And so obviously, like, Kerry finds this dead body with a moon cup in its mouth, and on it goes. And they get sort of sucked into their popular people's world. But I have also written something that was quite important to me, and it was that the narrator, Kerry, has anxiety and she's medicated for anxiety, which felt like quite an important thing for me to do because I wanted to have a book character who was very much living with anxiety and doing things and out there and doing stuff. And the entire story wasn't revolving around anxiety. It was just part of her active life. So to show her kind of out there doing stuff, solving crimes, remembering to take her meds.
I love that. Long-term listeners will know how much I bang on about just give us characters where they deal with mental illness and it's not their whole fucking character arc.
Yeah, because, you know, in real life, you have mental illness in your life and it doesn't become your whole everyday story. Like, it's not all of everything that you do all the time because you have a life and stuff. And also, having this mental health diagnosis doesn't mean that you're going to go on this amazing journey where you, like, hit rock bottom and you come up from it and then you're, like, saved and healed and everything's fine again. You know, there's no, like, crescendo moment to having mental illness. There's no great...
Yeah, there's no day where you just pass.
Yeah.
Cleared, done, finished.
You're like, it's done. Yeah. And also, like, you know, people have these, like, great eureka moments where they go, I've realized what's wrong with me and now I am fixed. And you're like, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you're a bit like me, it's more, I've realized all the 10,000 things that are wrong with me and now I must live my life.
And now I've realized all the things to do about them. Yeah. No, it's very true. And so I love this work. I'm, despite not knowing you nearly well enough to say it, I'm very proud of you. So congratulations.
Thank you. And then obviously I've put the period products in because I wanted everyone to kind of talk about period products in a different way. I sort of wanted to trick people into talking about them. I'd be like, see, it's not that bad. Talking about periods is not that taboo. I just thought if you put them in as something different, as something that's part of a different story, then, you know, just sneak them into things in a fun way. And also make people laugh about it because I really do want a tampon version of Baby Shark in my life.
I love that. And so on that note, we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for the chat today.
Oh, thank you for having me on. Great.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.